Continue our sermon series on looking at different parables this fall that are within Luke. And last week we looked at two parables, and today we'll look at one, which is unique to the Gospel of Luke. This parable is not in any of the three Gospels. You may recall that we started a couple weeks ago, we looked at talking about Jesus was at a table with Pharisees and scribes, and he watched them position themselves, who could sit with the best person. And he tells them a parable about a banquet dinner. And then Jesus is still at that table, and he's still talking to the Pharisees and scribes. As he talks, more and more people keep coming in. The outsiders keep coming in, the tax collectors, the sinners is what the Pharisees and scribes call them, the outcasts. And they get mad at Jesus because, like, hey, this is not for them. This is only for us. And then Jesus tells three more parables, two of which we read last week, and then one we read today. I invite you now to listen to God's word. Again, it's Luke 15, 11 through 32. And if you'd like to follow along in your pew Bible, you may. It's on page 78 in the New Testament section. Again, I invite you to listen to God's word. Then Jesus said, there is a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the wealth that will belong to me. So he divided his assets between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all that he had and traveled to a distant region. And there he squandered his wealth in dissolute living. When he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout the region, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of the region, who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled his stomach with pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired hands have bread enough and to spare? But here I am, dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands. So he set off and went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. Then the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his slaves, quickly, bring out a robe, the best one, and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. And get the fatted calf and kill it. And let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and he is found. And they began to celebrate. Now, his elder son was in the field. And as he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on. He replied, your brother has come home. And your father has killed the fatted calf because he has got him back safe and sound. Then he became angry and refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him, but he answers his father saying, listen, for all those years I have been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you have never given me a young goat so that I may celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came back, he was devoured your assets with prostitutes. You killed the fatted calf for him. Then the father said to him, son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. But what we had to celebrate, and rejoice, because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found. Friends, the word of our Lord. Thanks be to God. The world is scrambling for answers. Take a quick sample of the October headlines and reveals this much. A recent rise in robberies leave law enforcement and social workers scrambling for answers.
Three straight losses leave Tom Brady and the Buccaneers scrambling for answers. China stirs for oil, sends Beijing scrambling for answers. Threats of dirty bomb pushes the UN into scrambling for answers. The end of Roe has both Republicans and Democrats still scrambling for answers. Decline of school test scores have administrators, teachers, parents scrambling for answers, and whole generations are missing from the church pews. Pastors and elders are scrambling for answers. The painting on your bulletin depicts a group of people scrambling for answers. This is a fresco by Ben Long. It's located at the Montreat Chapel in Montreat, North Carolina, where our kids went this summer. And notice everyone there, the father scrambling to hold his youngest son. The youngest son scrambling to be embraced by his dad. The oldest son scrambling to make sense of all that is around him. Then there's the men scrambling in the background there to make a meal. Women and children scrambling as onlookers. And if you look closely, there's a woman, a lady running with her hands open. Some say this is the artist's idea of the mother, scrambling to embrace her son, but throwing her hands up in the air to, like, as if saying to the father, see, I told you this would happen. I told you he would come back looking like this. All this scrambling for answers took place long, though, before the youngest son came back home. Maybe it happened after countless sleepless nights and a well-crafted plan. Or maybe it happened irrationally with no plan at all and just sort of the spur of moment type of thing. Either way, the younger child, scrambling for answers, decides that love must not be enough. Having gotten what he needs in life, he asks for what he wants. He asks for what he covets and sets into the real world scrambling for meaning. With countless more sleepless nights, this younger child who set out into the world to find meaning discovers the meaning in coveting has led him to no longer know how much is enough. What he found was a rough world with little meaning at all. In the land of coveting, when all you get is what you get yourself, what meaning is sought with earning and striving, this young child, he fell off a cliff. And no one gave him anything, the text said. And he almost died. What Jesus gives us in this parable is an idea of what it's like to be God as parenting to us. Watching this world scramble to find meaning and substance through earning and strive in accumulation. And then before we go any further, we need to take a step back and acknowledge the idolization that our culture gives to parenting and how insensitive this can be to persons who desire children and are unable to have them, or those who do not wish to have children. With that said, parenting takes all of us. And whether we are parents through biology or through adoption, or grandparents or aunts or uncles or a loving adult, we all know what it's like to love a child. For 20 or so years, we anticipate good news as these children grow up, to graduate high school, to enter into college, to graduate, then after graduation, start a successful life. But as we scramble to provide a life for our own children, how much do we really give one another space to identify and explain what being a parent is really like? It seems we're so desperately scrambling to show one another how good of parents and loving adults that we are.
by the faultless manners of our children in public, or by their exemplary school results, or by their athletic prowess or artistic innovations. But where and when do we say to a parent who shouts or gives space for a parent, given too that we shout or weeps, or a parent who feels isolated or alone or a failure or just a fool? Samuel spoke recently about sitting down with a friend of his who spoke somewhat openly about what it meant to be like a parent to his teenage son, how his son lied to him, how his son wasted his brains and couldn't get into the rhythm of middle school, how he started taking various substances and how he stole money from his parents and how he felt like his son was beyond his reach. Tremendous fun and good company just about one out of every 5 days, but far away most of the time, and sometimes it's just a complete demon. I said to my friend, Wells recalls, how much was your sense of failure part of you and your wife splitting up now that you look back? He shook his head stubbornly. When he opened his mouth to deny it, no words came out. And then he reached that moment you sometimes get between two men with a pint of beer in their hands, when however well you know each other, you're not really allowed to do tears. You're not allowed to cry. So you put your drink down and you tell a joke instead. Why did God tell Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, my friend said, when he was 12 years old? Because if he had waited until he was 13, it wouldn't have been a sacrifice. This comes from a man who's had more professional recognition than most of us could ever dream of. But deep down, his experience of being a parent had unraveled every fragile and unresolved quality of his character and exposed every tiny inconsistency in his soul, leaving him with self-esteem no stronger than mashed potatoes. You can almost see it. God leaning forward as a parent leans forward to talk about their troubled middle school student. Often it is us who are those middle schoolers, scrambling to find answers in the meaning of life. And like a worried middle school parent, God leans in because God, like a worried parent, God knows how this story can play out. What God knows, what Jesus warns us about, is that when our scrambling of meaning for life is driven by earnings and strive, this will lead to a cliff. And like a parent, I believe that God looks at this world that is scrambling to find meaning through this accumulation and is devastated to see the intimacy of a parent and child that has grown so terribly stale. At the same time, in this parable, the older child of this loving family looks around and makes no new discoveries at all. And in this world of predictability, he spends his time scrambling to protect his status quo. You can count on love as far as it goes, he says. Care and joy, yeah, they're fine, just as long as you have a self-sustaining plan, he says. Hope is good, just have a backup, he says. Just keep your nose out of trouble. Toe the line. Hope the scale tips your way. You may not covet, but you sure don't trust either, he says. The other child of this loving family thought he knew how it all worked out. No need to get curious or risky, he thought. No need to scramble for meaning when you can count on the world working just the way it was. But looks can be deceiving. In his book, The Culture of Disbelief, Stephen Carter describes how when he speaks of civil groups, he often addresses the topic of the most dangerous children in America. He tells two stories. The first is about a terrifying day that he and his five-year-old daughter were caught up in this crossfire of gun battle between rival gangs in Queens. They were momentarily separated in the shooting, and he could not get to her until all the shooting had stopped. It was the most horrifying 5 minutes of my life, he says. When Carter tells this story, his audience genuinely gasps in horror and sympathy. Then Carter tells about a day he was commuting on a train from his home in Stamford, Connecticut to New Haven, where he taught at Yale. As the train made various stops, many teenagers got on board, headed for private schools along the train's route. One stop, a group of girls got on, and Carter happened to overhear their conversation. They were heatedly debating which community was more fashionable and exclusive. Was it West Point or was it Fairfield? One of the girls from West Point said it named a person of great wealth who lived in her town, only to be countered by the Fairfield girl who named an even wealthier resident who lived in her community. The argument raged back and forth, until one of the West Point girls came up with an announcement she saw that would trump out all other people. She named a world-famous entertainer who she claimed actually lived at West Point. Not true, not true, one of the Fairfield girls screamed. That's not true at all. The entertainer does not live in West Point, because she knows this. Well, she was only there in West Point visiting a friend, and she knew this, in fact, to be true because she had met this entertainer at her father's store. Hearing this, the West Point girl raised up and hooted and disdainful, "Your father? Your father has a store?" The Fairfield girl, realizing too late her faux pas, cringed in shame as the West Point girl drove this blade home. "What does this store sell?" she cried. "Hardware?" Carter then asked the audience, "Which of these two groups of children is more dangerous? The Queen gang members or the Connecticut private school girls?" Predictably, most of Carter's audience say the gang members definitely are more dangerous. And Carter points out that the gang members, as violent as they are, they're closed in by their own neighborhood. And tragically, will most likely be dead or in jail before too long. Those girls on the train, on the other hand, attend the best schools in the land. They would no doubt be admitted into the finest universities and go on to have very important careers, where they will make decisions that will affect a great many of people. In the long run, the world they see, the answers they seek, the meanings they choose worthy, may in fact be more lethal than the gang's bullets. Looks can be deceiving. The older child in his loving family looks upon a world and he sees certainty. And within that certainty is a world without much grace, not enough curiosity, and little risk. And he is wrong on all accounts. And turns out, he is as lost as his little brother. The world you see, the questions that you ask, the choices that you make, the meanings you seek, make all the difference in the kind of world in which you and I live. This parable. The parable begins, a man had two sons. And it's not just about a parent who had two children, but a parent who loved two children, went out to two children, was outrageously generous to these two children. I wonder this morning,
Where do you see yourself in this story? Do you relate to that youngest son? Seeking meaning, questioning everything, risking it all, scrambling to find answers through accumulation and earning and striving. But see a cliff that is coming closer and closer and closer to where you sit. Or do you relate to the older son? Not understanding why everything just can't be the same. Why can't everyone just play by the rules? Why is everything changing so rapidly? Confident that your history has all the answers. And what you're doing is scrambling to keep things just the way they are. With such scrambling, you have even noticed all your curiosity and grace and risk slipping away. Or maybe you find yourself relating to that parent who you can relate to what it means to have a child or a loved one follow a self-destructive path or a path with little grace, which hurts themselves, which hurts those around them and hurts you more than you can comprehend or want to admit. So you scramble for answers. Scramble for answers on how to fix the situation. I wonder if there's any consolation for any of us this morning. That no matter where we find ourselves, God is in pursuit of reunion with each of us. One so incredible that God is at work moving us from a position of scrambling to a position of receiving and embracing God's grace. There's a more famous painting of this parable than the one at Montreat. This painting was completed by Rembrandt. And in that painting, the son is kneeling down in front of his father, an elderly, dignified man. The father's hands are placed around his son's shoulders. If you look closely at the painting, you may notice one hand is masculine. But tapered fingers, on the other hand, they're distinctly feminine. When the Dutch priest Henry Nouwen first saw this, Rembrandt's masterpiece, he concluded, "There is no doubt that the Father is really a symbol of God's love, which is both paternal and maternal. And most important of all, a love that every one of us so desperately needs." And then Nouwen stopped scrambling for answers and became confessionally curious. The question is not, how am I to find God, but how am I to let myself be found by God? Not how am I to know God, but how am I to let myself be known by God? Not how am I to love God, but how am I to let myself be loved by God? This parable is telling us all to stop scrambling for answers and start asking questions, beginning with perhaps maybe the most important. Can I accept that I am worth looking for? Can I accept that I am worth looking for? Can I accept that I am worth looking for? Was Jesus' response? Is yes. Yes, yes. Stop scrambling. I'm running to you to tell you. Yes. Yes.